breakfast@breakfast.co.uk. Tell us the piece of music that you choose for your call and be part of Breakfast, 7 days a week here on BBC Radio 3.
We're broadcasting on 90 to 93 FM on digital radio. You can also listen to us live online in high-definition sound. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news now read by Lopa Kotari.
NATO forces in Afghanistan have temporarily suspended the training of local police officers in response to a recent wave of attacks by Afghan recruits. At least 15 soldiers were killed by trainee police officers in August alone. Existing recruits are to be re-vetted. The Pakistani authorities have arrested an imam who was involved in a blasphemy case against a Christian teenager. The police are investigating claims that he tampered with evidence by placing pages of the Quran in her bag. The girl, who's 14 but has a lower mental age, is facing life imprisonment for allegedly burning pages of the Quran. Reports from Syria say two bombs have gone off in central Damascus. The explosions took place near the headquarters of the Syrian Army and Air Force. Four people are thought to have been wounded. The Foreign Office says it's providing consular assistance to the family of a British boy and his father who drowned off the coast of Mallorca yesterday. It's thought the man jumped into the water to save his seven-year-old son who'd been swept off rocks by a wave. The former Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Menzies Campbell, has defended Nick Clegg from criticism that he had no clear strategy. A Lib Dem peer, Lord Smith, likened Mr Clegg to a cork bobbing around in water. But Sir Menzies said Mr Clegg was in charge of his brief and of his party. A jump in the number of cases of whooping cough has led the government to consider extending the vaccination programme to newborn babies. There have already been three times as many cases reported this year than during the whole of 2011. Great Britain's Paralympian rowers have taken gold in the mixed coxed four. In the dressage, Sophie Wells won silver in the grade four individual event. And in the last few minutes, Alad Davies has won gold in the discus. Tributes are being paid to Ethiopia's long-serving Prime Minister, Meles Zenawi, whose funeral is being held in the capital, Addis Ababa. South Africa's President Jacob Zuma said Ethiopia had lost a patriot and a visionary. And the weather? Today will be rather cloudy, with a little rain or drizzle at times across parts of the south of the UK. Elsewhere it should be drier, with spells of sunshine developing, but further cloud and rain will spread into northern Scotland later on in the day. And that's the latest BBC News and weather. The time is coming up to 3 minutes past one.
And it was read by Lopa Kotari. It's time now on Radio 3 for today's early music show, presented by Catherine Bott. Thank you.
a sonata for two violins and continuo by Handel, played by Nadia Tsvina and Walter Reiter, with continuo provided by cellist Joseph Crouch and harpsichordist Harry Bickett. And I'm delighted to say that Harry is my guest on today's Early Music Show. Welcome, Harry. That music goes under the billing of the English Concert, whose artistic director you've been for, how long is it now?
I think it's about 5 years, but I haven't been counting. But yes, about 5 years.
A good 5 years?
Wonderful 5 years. Absolutely amazing. The English Concert was the very, very first early music group that I ever heard, period orchestra I ever heard. I was at Christ Church, Oxford, as a young organ scholar, and they came and played for a wonderful disc of Purcell with the boys' choir, and one-man choir with Simon Preston. And I was totally blown away by that. And then when I came to London in the early 80s, I was rung up and asked would I like to come and play second harpsichord in a performance of Solomon at the Proms. And I really had very little experience of playing the harpsichord back then. I was really an organist and a pianist. I'd studied piano at the Royal College before that. So I felt like a bit of a fraud, but I thought, well, why not? This sounds like a good, fun thing to do. And it really was wonderful. And Trevor was very good to me. And I remember him sitting me down in the intermission and saying, that's great, Harry. You know, when you roll a chord on the harpsichord, you can go up, but you can also go down. And this is like my first harpsichord lesson of playing continuo. He was very generous to me. And it was kind of an amazing thing that my life should come full circle and end up being music director of the very same group 20, 30 years later.
What were your aims when you took over the English Concert? What sort of new broom did you want to sweep through?
Well, I think historically the English Concert was founded by Trevor originally, I think just as a trio. I think it was him and Stephen Preston and Tony Pleath.
Well, they were the Galliard were the trio original, way back
exactly,
before you were
exactly.
twinkling your
but
father's
eye. Trevor regards that as the beginning of the English Concert. And then I think as the group expanded, it was very much keyboard-based. You know, Trevor is just like the best harpsichordist ever, in my opinion. And a lot of the repertoire was based initially around a lot of the keyboard concertos. And then, of course, he expanded through the recording contract with Deutsche Grammophon to doing larger-scale works. After that, Andrew Manzi took over. And Andrew, of course, very much drawn towards the violin repertoire. So all of a sudden, they were doing a lot of Locatelli and Tartini and wonderful Italian violin repertoire, which he does so brilliantly. And so when I took over, the orchestra hadn't really done much vocal music, let alone a Handel opera, which is what I'd been doing for the previous 10 years. And it seemed to me a big hole if you have a period instrument orchestra playing music of the 18th century that you somehow managed to avoid singers and choruses.
Well, lots of people like to avoid singers.
Well, I know they do, but anyway, it seemed to me that is sort of what I spent my whole life being immersed in, and that was something I could bring, a new kind of repertoire. And I have to say, they've really grabbed hold of it, and yeah, it's been a wonderful ride.
And now all singers don't want to be avoided by the English Concert. I'm so glad you've mentioned it yourself, because it was going to be the very next thing that I mentioned, accompanying singers, because it goes with our next music. This is a duet from Handel's oratorio Belshazzar, sung by Rosemary Joshua and Sarah Connolly.
Thank you.
From the final scene of Handel's oratorio Belshazzar, the duet between the Babylonian queen Nitocris and the Persian king Cyrus, "Great Victor, I Bow at Your Feet." It was sung by Rosemary Joshua and Sarah Connolly with the English concert directed from the harpsichord by Harry Bickett, who's with me today. Harry, let's talk about your very early keyboard playing life. Talk me through your Oxford, Windsor, Westminster trajectory. I believe there's a royal wedding in it.
Well, it sounds all very grand. My family is not especially musical, but we were kind of brought up in a slightly Edwardian way. And so myself and my siblings all had to learn the piano because that's what young children did. We also had to do things like recite poetry and dance. But I was the only one that really stuck with the piano, and I had a wonderful piano teacher in Liverpool where I grew up. Also had a very, very nice neighbour, Sir Charles Groves, who was, of course, the conductor of the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic at the time, who let me go over and play the piano next door and his harpsichord, and all through my life was an incredible influence, really. So I went to the Royal College, and luck of the draw, I was taught by Yonti Solomon, a person I can't even begin to describe in terms of musical influence and artistic influence. Incredible man. But at the same time, I had won the scholarship to play the organ at St. George's Windsor. And what I used to do is I lived in Windsor Castle, sounds very grand,
as
a little apartment,
does,
as
yes.
one does, in return for which I had to play for services and be a kind of apprentice in the chapel. And also, as you say, playing for the royal family, which was, I used to get rung up at 1 o'clock in the morning and told that Her Majesty would like to come show some of her guests around the chapel after dinner and would like some organ music. I would noodle a quick voluntary. In fact, they used to come up to the organ loft, and I do remember sitting, and they come in behind me, and I'd look around, and suddenly there was the Queen Mother there, and then next minute there was Prince Charles, and then the Queen. And I do remember a tricky situation where Prince Charles said he'd like something loud. What about the Vidor Toccata? And then the Queen Mother said, "Oh, I think I'd like something rather soothing." And then the Queen said, "Well, what about some Bach?" And I did have one moment of, you know, seniority as to who I should obey there. But I did those two things for a little while, and then I went to Oxford for 3 years as an organ scholar at the cathedral. I then left Oxford and went to Westminster Abbey. I played for the royal wedding, the Andrew and Sarah Ferguson's wedding, which was a wild experience. And then shortly after that, I left and went to E&O because I'd worked with Mark Elder freelance, the BBC and various places, and he remembered and said, "Would you be interested perhaps in coming and working there?" So
you went straight from the absolute heart of the English church music world, Westminster Abbey, to English National Opera,
yeah.
Just like that.
Yeah, and at a time when it was the most exciting place in the world to work. I mean, all the people, all these sort of the old guard now, but in those days it was, you know, a young David Alden, Graham Vick, Tim Albury, David Freeman, Richard Jones, all these directors who were just sort of cutting their teeth and doing wild things, but also the beginning of doing repertoire, which really hadn't been done. Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk, Rusalka, Puccini, Dr. Faustus, a lot of contemporary music. I mean, it was my learning curve just shot up. My first day I walked in the stage door and they said, "Harry, you've got to go stage right, conduct the offstage band in Macropolis case." I mean, what stage right? And they took me through the dark, and there was a timpani and three trumpets. And I looked into the little camera, and there was Charles Mackerras starting the overture. And I just fell flat on my face. And Charles, being Charles, of course, called me out on stage and said, what's going on here? Who are you? Why?" So it was a real baptism of fire. Every day, I was just totally thrilled to be there. And I was there for 5 years, and I was involved in 60 operas.
Well, it's obvious that at every stage of your young playing life, a real talent was plain and identified by people who could help you on your way, from Charles Groves through to Mark Elder. So lots of conductors were spotting you as somebody they wanted to work with. But I'm sure you'd agree that luck plays a part in everybody's career. And I've got a note here, which says that you were a stand-in, you did a jump-in to take a significant part, not on stage, in Peter Sellers' production of Theodora at Glyndebourne in 1996. And that's become a sort of bit of a legend, that particular production of
Well, of course, and all those people that I first worked with there in that cast, Dawn Upshaw, Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, David Daniels, Richard Croft, and of course Peter Sellers himself, remained lifelong friends and colleagues. And in fact, I was just doing a production of Hercules with Peter and almost the same cast in Chicago last year, and we've kept up. But that was an amazing situation. I was an assistant to William Christie. I thought it was going to be a nice, easy summer, gently sitting, sipping Pimm's in Glyndebourne, talking to the sheep, and basically learning Theodora, because I was going to do it on the tour later that year, and I thought this is a nice way of introducing myself to the company, enjoying that. Bill Christie got sick and had to not conduct several of the performances, so I went straight in and did that, but it was like the most ideal situation. I'd been by then playing the harpsichord with the OE in the pit. We all knew each other. I knew the piece inside out. It's a great orchestra, a great cast, a legendary production in Glyndebourne. I mean, if you want to show what you can do, it doesn't come much more gold-plated than that.
We are going to hear something from Lorraine Hunt Libesson later on, an aria from Theodora indeed. But let's go to Susan Graham. What does Susan Graham bring to the famous aria we're going to hear now, which is our third music choice, which is What Is Life to Me Without You? I Have Lost My Eurydice. What unique thing does she bring to this iconic aria?
Well, with Susan, it's the voice. There's just something that it's spine-tingling to me to hear that instrument and that intelligence in a piece like this.
Mon malheur, sort cruel.
J'ai perdu mon Eurydice from Gluck's opera Orphée et Eurydice. Harry Bickett conducted the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment with mezzo-soprano Susan Graham in the title role of Orpheus. Harry, how did you first cross paths with the OAE?
Probably was at Glyndebourne the first time I actually sort of got to know them for the Theodora. Of course, I knew quite a lot of the players anyway. Like, the whole orchestral life in England is such that, you know, you meet players in different places. But that, I think, was the very first time I ever worked with them.
And where period bands are playing, there will often be Handel. And obviously Handel is very dear to your heart. Was he always?
No. I mean, of course, I loved it. But you have to remember, in the early 80s, when I was at university, Handel operas weren't deemed to be basically unstageable and not theatrical. The whole idea of opera seria was considered antithetical to what people wanted in opera. Of course, what's happened since then, are wonderful directors like, you know, Nick Heitner, David Alden, Richard Jones, who've taken these pieces and suddenly made them fascinating, kind of microscopic, psychological explorations of the human condition. And if it means someone standing on stage for 15 minutes and singing Scherzo and Fieder, then that is not untheatrical. That is actually a very moving thing. And one of Peter Sellers' great theories is that the da capo aria, far from being untheatrical, is actually very, very close to the way that human beings think. But it's in real time. So that it's not unnatural to say for 5 minutes, I love this woman, and then to say for maybe 2 minutes, but she betrayed me, and then to say for 5 minutes, but I love this woman. And the second time you say, I love this woman, is totally different, even though you're saying the same words.
You're embellishing the music to say just how much you love
her. But also because it's in the context of her betrayal, whereas the first time it isn't. And, you know, this is a very, very simple idea, but this is something that actually, without knowing it, I think when it's in the hands of a great, great artist, really seriously moves people. I mean, people go nuts because it's suddenly so truthful and so honest compared to Mimi and Rodolfo meeting and then 5 minutes later singing a love duet, which is kind of wonderful, but it is human emotions telescoped way out of any kind of normal timeline.
As it happens, we've got the combination now of Handel, the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, and the aforementioned and very deeply missed artist, Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. Bane of virtue, nurse of passions.
Absolutely. This is Irene, who's the sort of, you know, the devout Christian talking to her cult, saying, you know, you don't be seduced. And this music is very kind of twinkly, you know, but the voice says, don't be seduced by these things.
Oh,
Bane of Virtue, Nurse of Passions from Handel's Theodora. Harry Bickett conducted the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment with the late mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt Lieberson in the role of Irene. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott, and my guest today is harpsichordist, conductor and artistic director of the English Concert, Harry Bickett. I know that you're very keen, as well as working with professionals, to, as Hector says in the History Boys, and he is talking about pass the parcel, I should add, but he says, take it, feel it, and pass it on. And in the cause of passing it on, you've recently been imparting quite a lot of your knowledge to the next generation. Tell me about these masterclasses you held in June.
Well, this is a series of masterclasses. This is the second time we've done it, and we hold them in the Foundling Museum in London, which in itself is a wonderful place, not just physically, but also the resonance of what that means to us as an orchestra. It occurred to us that more and more people are rightly choosing to direct the 18th century repertoire not on a podium with a big baton in their hand, but actually from a keyboard, because we are a chamber orchestra, and this orchestra does not need someone to beat time for them. What it wants is someone who brings an idea, an imagination to the music that we're playing. And more often than not, that is done by someone at the harpsichord or from the violin or oboe. But it's very hard to learn these skills. Basically, as a conductor, we're fairly unique in that we're not allowed, or it's very difficult for us to actually practice in the privacy of our own rooms. Although I'm sure there are some people who actually stand in front of the bathroom mirror practicing their downbeat, it's actually not very helpful, because until you've actually got the orchestra in front of you, you don't know what works. And for a conductor, you learn very publicly, and the only reason why you know whether you've done a good job or a bad job is if someone asks you back. Orchestras generally don't say to the conductor, it would be more helpful if you could give a clearer upbeat there, or you're rushing there, or something like this. Generally, they just say, well, they're useless, or
they go away and moan in the canteen.
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of actually,
which is, you know, which I understand. I played in orchestras, and I'm sure I've done the same sort of thing. But I always try and encourage the English Concert to always try and get, you know, the conductor's there to get the best out of the orchestra, but I think the orchestra is also there to get the best out of the conductor. So these masterclasses are with people who have not had much experience in directing from the keyboard, but it's a chance for them to work with an absolutely first-rate orchestra, who are also there not to criticise and take them to pieces, but to actually be able to say, that's useful, that is not useful, that's actually quite annoying. So I think it's a learning process for all of us. And for me, I don't know why I conduct in a certain way, but if you have to help someone who clearly isn't getting what they want, then you also have to be able to look at your own ability and say, well, what am I doing that somehow does work, which you're not doing?
Well, this next music is definitely you directing the English Concert, the opening movement of Pergolesi's Stabat Mater. the opening of Pergolesi's glorious Stabat Mater, Daniel Denise and Andreas Scholl, with the English concert directed by Harry Bickett, my guest today on the Early Music Show. Harry, almost all the music we've heard today involves a singer or a brace of singers. What are the particular challenges, and I mean, of course, I do mean pleasures, of working with what I know percussionists call tuned shouters, i.e. singers?
It is a total pleasure for me, and I'm not just saying that because you're here. To me, all the music making I do relates to the human voice and to breathing. I think the way I react to music is a very physical, breathing, heartbeat way. And so for me, it's not just about having a singer there. I think the whole influence of the voice and phrasing comes to me from that. One of the great changes over the last 20 years, which I'm a big fan of, is that the early music movement, the orchestra movement, the period orchestra movement, whatever you want to call it, has now moved into another generation where actually it is allowed for Susan Graham to sing Purcell. It is allowed that Veselina Kazarova sings Ariodante. It's not just about early music singers. And goodness knows, there's some fantastic ones. And in many ways, those early years were thrilling, the way which singers also really pushed the boat in terms of trying to find a style. But I think now you hear these orchestras playing in a much more, to me, a much more expressive, free, open, not romantic way, but a way in which is full of heart. And I think Handel would be thrilled that these big names, these big personalities, these big divas are back on his stage singing his music. Because everything you read, it must have been like that in his day.
Which takes us neatly on to 7 years ago, 2005, and your debut with the Metropolitan Opera in New York. Renée Fleming. Now there's a big diva, but a very good-humoured and collaborative diva, as far as
absolutely, I know. Absolutely. And there was somebody who had sung Handel, as many young singers do, and loved it, but somehow got to a point where she said, oh, but I don't really do early music, and I don't know. And when we first met, so you must tell me what I'm doing wrong. And, I was saying, please, I'm like, this is Renée Fleming and Harry who? I mean, what who am I? What started in 2005 has become a wonderful collaboration, and we would, in fact, reprise the Rodelinda just last year. And I think she always says, it's just like such a wonderful workout. She says, I just feel like it just cleanses everything, not just my vocal cords and my technique, but also my, my spirit.
Thank you.
Soprano René Fleming and the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment with the aria Ritorna o caro e dolce mio tesoro from Handel's opera Rodelinda, the opera with which my guest, Harry Bickett, made his debut with the New York Met in 2005. Now, as we said earlier, you're pretty firmly embedded with the English concert. So what's next in store for you all?
Well, we have a lot more Handel. One of the great things about my kind of relationship in New York particularly and work over here is that Carnegie Hall decided 3 or 4 years ago that they'd like us to come and do a Handel festival. 3 years running, we're taking Handel opera and oratorio to be performed there. Many of these pieces, what's fascinating, in New York have not really been done. So we're doing Radamisto next year, I think Theodora the following year, and then Alcina, I think, is the plan for the third year. I mean, these pieces are not really known to New York audiences. And for Carnegie Hall, which is not exactly the epicenter of early music performance, to be promoting it as alongside the Berlin Philharmonic and these other great orchestras playing big symphonic works, I think is a wonderful sign of the times and a huge feather in our cap and great sort of show of confidence in the work that we've been doing the last few years on these pieces. So I'm absolutely thrilled that's happening. We are also doing those pieces in the Barbican around Europe, all with just wonderful casts, and I'm looking forward to that immensely.
Well, it's been so kind of you to ruin your own lunch hour to talk to the early music show. I think I'd probably better let you get back to work. But before you go, our last music today is a track from your most recent recording with the English Concert. And it's a disc of Bach arias with one of my favourite young British sopranos, Elizabeth Watts. She's absolutely terrific. The aria we're going to play is Wie Zittern und Wanken from Cantata 105, and it features one of his intricate oboe obbligatos, played here by Katharina Spreckelsen. Just one last quick question. Why did you and Liz put this on the album?
Well, it's music from another planet. I mean, it's the most extraordinary writing, and I just think anybody who is going to, any soprano that's going to do a Bach disc and has a player like Katharina Spreckelsen on hand would put this down on their disc.
Thank you.
aria Wie Zittern und Wanken from Bach's Cantata BWV 105, performed there by the soprano Elizabeth Watts and oboist Katharina Spreckelsen, with the English concert directed by Harry Bickett. And it ends today's early music show, which was presented by Catherine Bott and produced in Salford by Les Pratt. And just to add, from tomorrow morning, you can download a podcast version of that programme from the Radio 3 website. Just follow the links to the early music show pages.
Desert Island Discs. For this week's Castaway, ladies and gentlemen.
Let's have a first choice of record.
Thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
On BBC Radio 3, to celebrate 70 years of Desert Island Discs, some of the most popular music choices are performed live at the BBC Proms. Keith Lockhart conducts the BBC Concert Orchestra and Kirsty Young interviews castaways from the series.
And if the waves were to crash to the shore and wash away the discs, which one would you run to save?
Desert Island Discs at the BBC Proms. Here on BBC Radio 3, tomorrow night at 7:30.
And during the interval of that prom, Mariella Frostrup examines the book choices of The Great and the Good over 70 years of Desert Island Discs, with help from previous castaways Sir Tim Rice and Dame Harriet Walter. That's the prom interval tomorrow night here on Radio 3. It should be at around 8:30. The prom itself starts at 7:30. As for today, we've two proms live from the Royal Albert Hall at 4:00. The second of a pair of organ proms this weekend, given by Cameron Carpenter. Another Bach programme from him this afternoon. And then at 7:30, the second of two proms this weekend by the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra under Ricardo Schei. Their programme this evening including Olivier Messiaen's war memorial piece Et Expecto Resurrectionem Mortuorum, complete with its apocalyptic gongs, and Mahler's Sixth Symphony with its hammer blows of fate. So that's Bach at 4 and Messiaen and Mahler at 7:30 here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. 2:00 and now Sunday concert, and it's another chance to hear the prom given on the 20th of August. Penny Gore was there to introduce it.
Tonight at the Royal Albert Hall, we'll be hearing one of the best-known concertos in the orchestral repertoire, Mozart's Clarinet Concerto. Together with a piece receiving only its second proms performance, the tone poem Eventyr, or Once Upon a Time by Frederick Delius, based on a collection of Norwegian folk tales. With Beethoven's Egmont Overture to begin and Carl Nielsen's Fifth Symphony to end, it's going to be an evening of vivid colours and contrasts from the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Osmo Vanska, and with Michael Collins joining the lineup to play basset clarinet in the Mozart. Well, more of that later. Beethoven is first, with music written for a Goethe play of 1788 that tackled weighty themes of oppression and injustice. The Flemish Count Egmont refuses to submit to despotic Spanish rule. He won't compromise his principles of liberty and freedom of expression, and for that he dies a martyr. Well, Beethoven was famously a man of strong opinions himself, not to mention a great admirer of Goethe's writings, and he shared many of the views expressed by Egmont. So in 1809, when he was asked to supply the incidental music for a restaging of the play at Vienna's Burgtheater, he accepted gladly. He eventually went on to produce 9 separate pieces of music to accompany the action at various points, a mixture of vocal and orchestral pieces. The most famous of them, and the most enduring, was the powerful overture that we're about to hear from the BBC Symphony Orchestra. And the players are just putting the finishing touches to their tuning here on the platform. And I must say, an enormous audience tonight here at the Royal Albert Hall. People have come out in force to hear tonight's programme. I suspect Michael Collins and the Mozart being a particular draw. And applause now for the guest leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Helena Wood. And here comes Osmo Vanska. Members of the orchestra rise as he makes his way to the podium to begin tonight's prom with Beethoven's overture, Egmont.
Thank you.